Interestingly, we're going to be talking to many guests throughout the next 3 hours, 3 hours at Abbey Road Studios, celebrating 50 years since this album was released in the UK. It came out a few days later in America, which meant lots of people went to their local import shop to try and get the LP early. And who could blame them? A matter of days was important to get hold of the next Beatles album. I'm now joined by Gary Brooker from Procol Harum, of course.
How do you do?
Gary, I mean, there are lots and lots of connections between you and the Beatles, but let's first of all start with the obvious one. White as Shade of Pale was a huge favourite of John and Paul, all the Beatles, in fact. John had a record player in his Rolls Royce, and people tell stories of how he used to play it in the car all the time.
He did, right? Yeah.
It was the record of 1967, along with Sgt. Pepper and All You Need Is Love, wasn't it?
Well, it seems to be in retrospect, yes. I mean, that was over 50 years ago, and it still seems to be going strong now. I did New Year's Eve once, walking on King's Road. The door of this Rolls Royce car opened, and this voice said, "Hey, Gary, get in." And it was John, and he had White Shade of Pale on his little record player. It was New Year's Eve. It was nearly midnight, you know, and I got fed up with all the pubs and that I'd try and walk through. So I spent it with John in his car, so it was nice.
Yes, that was a rather unexpected journey then, yeah. But you started, before Procol Harum, you started in a band called The Paramounts back in 1962. The same sort of influences that the Beatles had, the kind of music that you'd be playing, the R&B numbers all loved.
All the bands from those days, I think, were influenced by mostly black American music. And some of the rock and roll, like Jerry Lee and Carl Perkins and whatever, you can hear it in the Beatles. We actually, with the Paramounts, we signed with EMI in 1963, and we started recording immediately here in Studio 2.
And what was that like when you first came into the studios? What sort of impression did it leave on you?
Oh, well, it was a proper place. You know, we were making a record, and it was... We're here at last. Well, not at last, but and it got in the top 30 as well, which was even better. It was a great studio because it had a big cupboard that you could find lots of instruments in, and they ended up in people's records.
Lots of sound effects in that cupboard too, which appeared on Beatles records and probably Procol Harum records as well.
Yeah, we made two albums here, Salty Dog and Home.
Yeah.
And a lot of it came out of the cupboards, and some of the ideas for songs even, were out of the instruments that were in there.
So the sounds of the sea and the seagulls in A Salty Dog would have been Abbey
Road.
It
came from the EMI tape library. I said, "We're going to have seagulls," and somebody went somewhere. the man in the white coat went somewhere and came back with seagulls.
So. Yeah. And did you work with any of the Beatles engineers, Jeff Emerick or Phil McDonald or those kind of guys?
I don't... Can't remember that far back.
Okay.
I'm not sure who was the engineer with the Paramounts. I'm not sure who was the engineer. It was somebody called Norman, I think.
Oh, Norman Smith.
That's him?
Yeah, he recorded the Beatles up to the Rubber Soul, the end of 1965. Yeah.
And then with Procol Harum, there was somebody else that was an engineer. I can't remember their name either.
What about the Beatles as an inspiration? What did you take from them? Was it all the things? The performance, production... What were you being inspired by?
I always liked them because with the Paramounts, we toured with them in 1965 in Britain on their last British tour. We got on very well with them. They were nice guys. They were brilliant harmony. I mean, you had to be in the wings to be able to hear them because out front it was all screaming. So we became very aware that the Beatles actually were quite... brilliant singers. That was the most important thing that I found with them. We were Stones fans, really. I mean, you're either Stones or Beatles, and I was the Stones for a while until about Rubber Soul, and I thought, no, this is getting serious now.
Right. What was it about Rubber Soul then that made you shift your opinion?
It just suddenly sounded the craft and the it was all there. The first two or three albums, there was lots of covers on them as well. I heard you say earlier that they seem to have written loads of songs before they even became the Beatles, Lennon and McCartney, but surprisingly, there was always, like, you know, 2, 3, 4 covers on those early albums.
Yeah, the early albums, the formula was 8 originals and 6 cover versions.
Well, here we are.
Yeah, yeah. And then they built in confidence, and Hard Day's Night, actually, third album, is all John and Paul songs.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that, there's more covers on Beatles for Sale, the next British album. But by the time of Help, you know, there are 2 covers on Help, but their songwriting is progressing and progressing, and Rubber Soul is all them.
Yes.
And so let me pick you up on that last tour. It's the last time they played on a tour in Britain. It was December 65.
Mm-hmm.
Rubber Soul was out, and they did do a few songs from Rubber Soul in that set, I think. Did it, If I Needed Someone?
I can't remember what it was. Either it was either Day Tripper or...
Yeah, they did Day Tripper, and I think they did If I Needed Someone and Nowhere Man, I think, on that tour as well.
Oh, probably, yeah.
I mean, to do the harmonies on both those songs, If I Needed Someone and Nowhere Man, when everybody's screaming...
Well, what about screaming, was Paper Writer on
No,
there?
It wasn't out by that time.
Oh, no, no, right. Well, no. That was not it then, no. Must have been what I said.
But they were still able to sing those harmonies even...
Oh, yes.
Even when the people were screaming the place down?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you stand on the side of the stage in a theatre like where we were playing, they've got little speakers which play what the band is singing, actually.
Right.
They're like cue speakers in the days of, you know, plays and things. So we used to hear what they sang very clearly, and that was always brilliant.
Right. The lyricist that you use, Keith Reid, obviously came up with incredible... lyrics. Was he inspired by the kind of I Am the Walrus, Strawberry Fields Forever, John Lennon kind of surreal wordplay? Is that, did that give him license to do that kind of material?
Oh, well, I'm not him, so it's hard to answer that, but I think he might have even predated that a little bit.
Hmm.
I should think probably some fantasy of some of Bob Dylan's stuff just before then.
Yes.
May have been some sort of inspiration.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, it's not my department.
Right. You continued your association with the Beatles because you played on George's solo albums, quite a few albums that you were on with George.
Yeah, I did quite a few with George.
And what was it like working with George in his solo career?
Oh, it was marvellous. You know, he was a very nice man. We both liked trees, so we used to walk around his garden for 3 hours and then go and do a little bit of work.
Yeah.
But no, I sadly missed him when he went. I had the great fortune to be on the concert with George, which was a remarkable experience. I was actually in Paul McCartney's Rockestra.
Yes, on the Back to the Egg album. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was also did a few albums with Ringo, and I've been in his All Stars. There we are. But who hasn't?
Well, you know, we were talking about Ringo. I mean, he's an extraordinary drummer and just perfect for the Beatles, isn't he? The way that he played on those albums.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I ever... Well, I mean, he used to play when we were touring with them, but, you know, you can't always appreciate everything that people are doing. And actually, I wasn't playing with him anyway, but when I did, I think it was something like My Sweet Lord that I played on. And Ringo, I thought, Ringo has got a real good groove. You know, lovely time, you know, just hung there exactly how it could. And he moved it, although it was quite simple drums. It just moved very nicely with Ringo playing. I thought, he's not just Ringo, he's he actually plays good drums too.
And you worked with George Martin on one of your solo albums, No More Fear of Flying. So
yeah.
How was that, working with George?
Well, George was... everybody says he's a gentleman. I think he's a bit of a scamp sometimes. But
why do you say that?
Well, he's not a scamp. He was always dogged with bad luck, George, in physically speaking. I've been with him when he's been electrocuted, when he's fallen off the side of a wall and cut his finger on a glass, and that was all within half an hour. But, I mean, he's broken both wrists trying to stop a winch pulling his boat out. You name it, there's always something happening with him.
Yeah. But he had a great talent for being able to allow people to be themselves, didn't he? I mean, he in that way he was perfect for the Beatles because he didn't try and stamp his own authority on what they were doing. He was allowing them to be what they wanted to be and not dictating.
Yeah, and he saw that and he saw what was there, and he obviously heard a song and thought, I see how this can be. But, you know, his little touches he put in, orchestrally speaking, with the idea of, you know, a few strings here or not, they all worked beautifully and they've become part of the Beatles, I mean, but very important part, I think.
Yeah. I think an absolutely essential ingredient to the Beatles records was George Martin's arrangements, and we were talking about how the harmonies as well, he would help him in arranging the harmonies on something like Because on Abbey Road.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We're listening to tracks from the wonderful 50th anniversary edition of Abbey Road, which has got some fascinating outtakes, which really give you an insight to the way this album was recorded. It was clear to me when I listened to the session tapes that actually they were really getting on still in 1969. Rock mythology seems to say that they were not talking to each other because it was Apple and it was financial dealings and all that kind of thing. But there was a great love between them still when they were making those records. And I don't know if you talked to George about that, particularly when you were working with him, but I know that All Things Must Pass was recorded quite soon after the split. Did you feel there was quite a lot of acrimony at that point between them?
No. Didn't feel it, no. And I would never have asked George about something of the Beatles like that, you know.
Right.
That wouldn't have been proper.
No. Okay. Well, let's listen to one of our session outtakes from this anniversary box set on the Beatles channel on Sirius XM. I'm Kevin Howlett, and it's great to celebrate this album at the place where most of it was recorded. We've been talking to Gary Brooker from Procol Harum. I'm now delighted to say Muff Winwood is here, who, of course, was in the Spencer Davis group and then crossed to the other side, became a producer, an A&R man in record companies, produced many, many people for Island Records. There was an amazing London scene, wasn't there? And a lot of musicians used to socialise at late-night clubs like the Speakeasy and places like that. I think that's where the Beatles first heard A Whiter Shade of Pale being played by probably a DJ in a club.
Yeah. Well, so there was also the Flamingo.
Yeah.
Quite a few clubs prior to the Speakeasy, but, you know, they were, yeah. The London scene was one thing, up north was something else, you know.
Yeah.
And Birmingham, nobody knew where that was.
Not so easy to get to Birmingham. And I have to thank all the guests who came in. Tammy and Mike from Idaho, who were the Beatles Channel competition winners. We had Tony Hicks from the Hollies, Nile Rodgers, who has a creative role at Abbey Road Studios, Giles Martin, who's done the wonderful 2019 stereo mix and Dolby Atmos mix, Alex Tremble. It was really interesting talking to him, a young musician inspired by the Beatles from his band Two Door Cinema Club. Great songwriters like Russ Ballard, Graham Goldman, Roger Greenaway. We had 80 stars, Howard Jones and Bananarama.
Wow, how great.
Gary Brooker from Procol Harum.
Yeah,
Muff Winwood from Spencer Davis Group. Graham Parker. So we've had a really busy time here. So, phew, what fun this has been. So there is only one way to end this program for Sirius XM on the Beatles channel. The end of the end. It's Abbey Road. This is the way that the fantastic long medley finishes. So don't forget, the new Abbey Road box set is out tomorrow. Let's finish How the Beatles Do It. Here's the end. I'm Kevin Howlett. I've been broadcasting live from the world-famous Abbey Road Studios.